The time is now 6 o'clock. Welcome to WORT's local news for Wednesday, March 19th, 2025. I'm your host, Vicki Iden.
And I'm your host, Robert McClure. In tonight's news, no shock here. New research suggests that clean energy sources are the best way to meet rising demand for electricity.
An incumbent alder describes her data-oriented approach to leadership.
And in the second half, we'll get more details on last week's protests on Library Mall, revisit some headlines from 56 years ago, and, of course, broadcast all the details about the snowstorm we've got going on at the moment.
All these and more on tonight's news, but first we go live to the BBC for some news from around the world.
BBC News with Sue Montgomery. President Trump has suggested that the United States might take ownership of Ukraine's nuclear power plants to ensure their security. White House officials say the proposal came in Mr. Trump's hour-long phone conversation with President Zelensky on Wednesday. The State Department spokeswoman Tammy Bruce told reporters the talks had been extremely constructive.
President Zelensky thanked President Trump for the support of the United States, especially the Javelin missiles that President Trump was first to provide, and his efforts towards peace. The leaders agreed Ukraine and America will continue working together to bring about a real end to the war, and that lasting peace under President Trump's leadership can be achieved.
Thousands of people are demonstrating in Istanbul against the arrest of the city's mayor, Ekrem İmamoğlu. All protests have been banned for 4 days. Some of the gatherings have been violently broken up by police. Mr. İmamoğlu is seen as the main political rival to Turkey's president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, as Emre Temel from the BBC Turkish service explains.
Mr. İmamoğlu seemed ready to use Istanbul mayorship as the launchpad for the ultimate prize, presidency. He's a very popular politician, won the mayoral race twice in 2019, and was resoundingly re-elected last year. Mr. İmamoğlu is expected to be named as main opposition Republican People Party's presidential candidate in a primary vote on Sunday. However, yesterday his university diploma was revoked. This move was largely seen by the opposition as an eliminating from the Turkish politics because a college degree is a constitutional requirement.
Mexico's attorney general has criticized state officials for their handling of a ranch in the state of Jalisco that's feared to have been used by cartels for mass killings. Will Grant reports.
Alejandro Goertz didn't hold back in recognizing failings by the state authorities in the case of the alleged cartel crematorium site in Jalisco. He opened his news conference by saying the state-level investigators who raided the ranch last September had not taken the proper fingerprints and forensic tests, nor registered the hundreds of items of clothing which were found at the location. Pressed by journalists on whether his office considered that the site could be defined as a cartel extermination and training site, as it has been described by activists, Attorney General Goertz said, in essence, that it was too soon to tell.
The Israeli military has extended its ground operations in Gaza a day after it resumed airstrikes in the Palestinian territory. Israeli forces say they've expanded their presence up to the so-called Netzarim corridor, which divides the north and south of the strip. The UN has called for an inquiry after a staff member was killed when an explosive hit a UN compound. BBC News. A judge in New York has ruled that a student of Palestinian origin, Mahmoud Khalil, who led protests at Columbia University against Israel's military campaign in Gaza, can challenge the legality of his arrest. Neda Taufik in New York has more details.
Judge Jesse Furman ruled that the case must be transferred to New Jersey, where Mahmoud Khalil was detained when his lawyers petitioned for his release. He left in place an order halting Mr. Khalil's deportation. The judge said this was a case where judicial review was critical because of plausible claims that the administration had violated the law or exercised its otherwise lawful authority in an arbitrary and discriminatory manner. The Trump administration has invoked a rarely used law to justify his deportation, claiming without providing evidence that he took part in pro-Hamas events that threaten U.S. foreign policy. Mr. Khalil denies that.
President Trump has warned Iran against sending more aid to the Houthis in Yemen as the U.S. continues its military campaign against them. Mr. Trump said the rebels would be completely annihilated and that stopping supplies to them immediately would speed up their defeat. Dozens of people have been killed in the current U.S. bombardment, which began last week. A U.S. court has instructed Greenpeace to pay hundreds of millions of dollars in damages to a major pipeline operator. Energy Transfer had accused the environmental group of conducting a campaign of violence and defamation against the Dakota Access Pipeline nearly a decade ago. Members of a Native American tribe said it threatened their water supply. The European Space Agency has released the first tranche of data from its Euclid Space Telescope, which is attempting to map the cosmos. It's produced a mosaic of millions of distant galaxies. Together, the images cover 10 billion years of cosmic history. BBC News.
Good evening, this is Rob McClure and Vicki Iden bringing you your local news live from the WORT studios on Bedford Street in a wet and now snowy downtown Madison. Here are the headlines for this evening.
Minnesota Governor and former vice presidential candidate Tim Walz spoke at a town hall-style event in Eau Claire yesterday, outlining steps for opposing the Trump and Elon Musk administration. Walz emphasized the importance of Wisconsin's Supreme Court election this spring as a crucial step. The race between liberal Dane County Judge Susan Crawford and conservative Waukesha Judge Brad Schimmel will decide the ideological majority of the court. Walz also took aim at Republican Congressman Derek Van Orden and other Republicans for moving away from in-person town hall events.
Yesterday was also the first day of in-person absentee voting for the April 1st election, and Madison voters set a new record according to the Madison Clerk's office. Nearly 2,500 people voted in-person absentee, the highest total ever for the first day of an early voting in a spring election. April 1st's balloting is designated as a nonpartisan election. And outside the state Supreme Court race, the other principal statewide contest is for state superintendent of schools. There, incumbent Jill Underley is facing a challenge from Brittany Kinzer. Also on the ballot will be another amendment that seeks to enshrine voter ID in the state constitution.
The federal civil trial of a former Wauwatosa officer kicked off Monday in Milwaukee, reports the Wisconsin Examiner. It's taken 5 years to get here. The case surrounds the appropriate use of force from then police officer Joseph Mensa, who in 2020 killed 17-year-old Alvin Cole after a chase through a mall parking lot. Prosecutors say Mensa used excessive force, but Mensa's lawyers say the shooting happened quickly after a chaotic foot chase in a darkened parking lot and were in line with police protocols.
A group of parents is lobbying for more special education funding in the upcoming state budget. The Learn in My Shoes campaign brought shoes to the state capitol today, with stories of students with disabilities across the state pinned to each pair. One shoe will go to the state representative and the other to the state senator who represents them. It's a project of two Wisconsin mothers hoping to highlight the level of funding local school districts receive for the cost of special education services. They're requesting legislators double the reimbursement to at least 60% of those costs, which is also the same increase called for in Governor Tony Evers' current budget proposal.
The UW-Madison Police have a new chief as of Sunday. Brent Plisch will head up the department, overseeing 155 employees and a potentially shrinking budget. Plisch headed up the department as interim chief after the speedy departure of Kristen Roman. He has 2 decades of experience at UW-Madison. Speaking with the Capital Times, Plisch outlined how federal budget cuts could mean the loss of officers on the force. And when asked how UWPD would respond to immigration officials on campus, Plisch said that campus police isn't staffed to assist.
Got something to say about the local police department? Madison's nascent independent monitor will hold a community listening session this Friday. The independent monitor is an independent watchdog over the Madison Police Department. It was set up to keep the MPD accountable and responsive to the community. Friday's listening event will be in person on East Olin Street and virtually via Zoom at 5 p.m. More info on the session is at thecityofmadison.com. And those were the headlines for this evening. Now on to the rest of the day's top stories.
Demand for electricity is expected to keep going up. To keep pace, Wisconsin's biggest utility wants to build a new gas plant in the southeastern part of the state. But new research shows the best way to meet demand is to double down on multiple cleaner sources and prioritize a reliable power grid. Mike Moen of Wisconsin News Connection has more.
Wisconsin's largest utility provider is seeking approval for a new gas plant to help meet growing electricity demand, but a new report says there are better ways to create a more reliable energy grid. Data centers are among the many reasons there's added pressure on the nation's power grid. The nonpartisan think tank Energy Innovation says that's setting off panic with talk of slowing the pace of coal plant closures and spurring new natural gas plant development. The group's Sarah Baldwin hopes decision-makers don't suddenly abandon the transition to renewables.
The report points to the fact that wind and solar and battery prices have all come down substantially over the last few years, and in many cases have exceeded the forecast for their cost declines.
Natural gas burns cleaner than other fossil fuels, but the authors say quickly pivoting to gas now would result in too many long-term costs. Baldwin says wind and solar won't do it alone, but using a range of renewables, along with low-risk supplemental sources, aids reliability. We Energy says its proposed plant in Kenosha County is part of a long-term vision that includes renewables and the end of coal use. One recommended supplemental energy source is better management of the power already being generated, incentivizing people to adjust their energy use during peak times. Researchers recognize that it might be hard to motivate enough people to sign on. And while there isn't a clear consensus about how to move forward, Baldwin says the news isn't all that bad.
We are not in an energy emergency. We actually have time to do this in a very pragmatic and thoughtful way and avoid some of the fear-mongering that we're seeing right now.
She adds grid operators and utilities would be well-served to help dispel long-standing myths about renewables. Baldwin thinks they should also remain focused on removing barriers to plugging clean energy sources into the grid, noting there's still a backlog of development ready to power up homes and businesses. As for the We Energy's proposal, state regulators could decide its fate in the coming months. This is Mike Moen for Wisconsin News Connection. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
The time is now 6:13, and you're listening to the live local news on community radio station WORT. Incumbent Alder Sabrina Madison has represented Madison's northeast side on the city council since 2022. This year, she faces one challenger in Sean Burke, who has previously run for the Dane County Board of Supervisors. Theirs is widely regarded as the most contentious race on the ballot this spring. Speaking with our news producer, Faye Parks, Alder Madison touted the city's progress on the Imagination Center.
Hey, I'm Sabrina Madison. I have lived in Madison since somewhere around 2007 or 8. I have served on Madison's Common Council, representing District 17, since I was first appointed back in October 2022.
Now, why run for another term on the council? What inspires you?
Yeah, so I've been super successful thus far in my term, and I'm having a lot of fun at it. Part of why I want to run again is because I'm very much a solution and process oriented. And one of my main goals, for example, was to help constituents get what they have been advocating for years, which is the library. Right now, the library, it's not exactly in 17. It's in 12, but it used to be in 17 before the area was redistricted. I've been able to like really raise a profile of that. We've gotten several grants since I've been in office, and folks no longer refer to it as the Imaginary Center because, you know, they kind of had lost faith in it really coming to fruition. And now they're on board to help me advocate for it. So right now we have more buy-in towards the project. Plus we have the residents of the district participating, whether it is talking to the news, whether it is coming to a meeting, whether it's speaking at council, whereas before that wasn't happening because people just felt like, oh my God, it's been, you know, 10 plus years and this thing is never going to happen. So probably the biggest accomplishment for me is seeing this library project through and getting people back on board with it and taking part and not giving up hope.
Is there something in your latest term that you really tried to get accomplished but were unable to for whatever reason?
I don't think so. Simply because I can be very nerdy. I grew up in libraries. I'm absolutely a library nerd. And a lot of things that I work on, I sort of take an approach, almost like a data approach to it. So early on in my term, I had a meet and greet with other alders on the east side. I had an engagement dinner over in my district. And what I did was compiled information from residents who attended those meetings. And then I worked with I think she's a PhD candidate potentially at the time, but I worked with a student over at UW-Madison who helped me compile and organize that information. And so what that allowed me to do is to create themes for what people wanted me to work on. So they wanted increased constituent engagement. I've done that. They wanted this library to come to fruition. We're on our way, like it's just out to bid. They wanted someone who would, you know, help kind of like alleviate some of the issues around the challenges, for example, around dumping in our area. That has been resolved, you know. So I don't think there isn't anything that I set out to do because, one, I understand you can only accomplish so much in 2 years. It's more about creating the sort of like, have I had progress since I've been in office? And yes, there is lots of evidence that I've made progress in those areas that folks told me at those various community engagement events.
Housing is perhaps the most complex and sprawling issue the city faces. A recent city report found that the income needed to pay Madison's median monthly rent without becoming housing cost burdened correlates to a full-time job paying about $28 per hour, or $58,000 a year. This issue is so complicated it's hard to know where to start. What do you believe is an achievable jumping-off point to address Madison's affordable housing crisis?
There is not one single answer that I can give you that does not include our state legislators. It literally is a collaborative effort because, one, you have the cost to build housing, right? There are things that we can do, which is land bank, you know, areas of the city to make it a bit more affordable. You know, you could add some density bonuses or height bonuses rather to certain buildings. But that still is not bringing the rent down enough for people who earn at that 30% or lower AMI. So if you earn, I don't know, $40,000 a year, what I just mentioned will not, to a degree, all the way help you. We really do need more partnership from the state and federal level in order to get us there. Because one, you know, if folks were following the city's budget going on last year, we're also still in a budget deficit. Thankfully, the referendum passed, but that just kept us, you know, kind of like operating as is. It didn't give us a whole lot more to do more with housing. Again, I have not seen a single solution that we have at our disposal to a degree that would get us out of this housing crisis in the next 10 years. Whatever we're doing and continue to do over the next 10 years is not going to get us there at the rate, the speed that we need to get there without some help outside of the county.
Now, you mentioned the budget earlier.
Yep.
Madison voters faced an unusual choice in November and ultimately decided to say yes to a city funding referendum on the ballot that raised property taxes. Mm-hmm. Still, city finance leaders say the city's structural budget deficit is a chronic issue worsening over time. What is one way you would lead the city to address the budget deficit outside of raising property taxes again?
The things that people need in order to be stable and well and cared for are greatly underfunded. For example, a sizable chunk of our budget is for police. And so I'm always thinking about how do we balance our needs, the community's needs, with being able to house our homeless neighbors. Perfect thing for me. I always sit down and say, yes, MPD or fire or whomever the other agency, streets, whatever, they want X, or they tell us they need X. But then I'm over here, when I drive home, I am seeing 200, 300, 400 men in line. How do I drive by those men and decide to give them less and decide to give X more? I know I can't do that. But what I do is have those conversations with folks who are asking for more, even though these folks have less, to say, what is it that you can give up so we can balance continuing to serve them? So for me, there is no, I can't give you like, I will do this things, because it also takes sitting down and having a conversation to say, what are you willing to give up or not have right away in order to keep these folks housed? And that's pretty much what I've done thus far.
I want to ask how you think about your role on the council. Alders have two priorities to their constituents and their districts and to the city of Madison. Sometimes those priorities conflict. How would you handle an issue that drives forward the city's goals but is unpopular among your constituents?
What I've seen in this last, you know, couple of years since I've been on council is that for whatever reason, you know, this is my first time in politics, people will get very upset and tied to an idea of something that ticks them off for some reason or another. And they haven't really processed the thing, like the value of the thing. And then when they talk about, oh, we don't need this because of whatever, and you really hear them, they never mention the benefits. They just say, oh, the city doesn't need to spend its money on this thing, without actually talking about the qualities. Even though we could talk about the qualities or the benefits, and you can still disagree at it. I just want to see more people process the thing that they're angry about or they want to fight against. Because for some people, there is some benefit. At the end of the day, Madison is a place where a lot of folks are doing well, but a whole lot of folks are not doing well at all. So we have to be thinking about what's good for the greater good of our city.
What is the tenor of this spring's campaign between yourself and your opponent?
Yeah, so just to be frank with you, and I always say this is all public record because our emails are public record. So everything I'm about to say is documented. My opponent, I think he filed on the last day, which I had heard rumors, you know, that he was at a former mayor's house potentially talking about this thing, which is, that's his right, and that's that former mayor's right, you know, that I don't have anything against that. But I also thought about, do these folks know his history? And yes, lots of folks know his history. I'm not going to go into why he may be doing this, but I'll tell you what he has done to me. I got a point in October 2022, within, I don't know, let's just say 2 weeks, he had reached out and talked about some of his housing issues with a local organization that was funded by the county. And so I looked into it and realized, okay, this is a grant not from the city. This is a grant with the county. And so I got myself educated pretty quickly on what his concerns were about that organization and that grant. And what I learned pretty quickly is that there was some tension between my opponent and that organization and some issue of funding. But what I also learned is that numerous county supervisors were already trying to assist in tackling the issue, and a great number of city staff had been too. And what I learned pretty early on, every alternative, every resource, every conversation was not necessarily about him getting the help that he was asking for. It was used as an opportunity to sort of have a conversation about that organization or the grant. So, you know, this has happened over my first couple months. And then at some point, it just began to escalate. Once my opponent realized that I am not going to entertain, you know, like, you're literally every alternative that myself, the city, and the county is on these emails too, would offer, and MPD would offer him, it was always, but this organization, but this person, even though I am saying, and we are saying, I literally can, there's nothing I can do about a county's grant. You know, I just, the county doesn't send us their stuff to approve or not approve, you know? And so once I say, okay, you're being very disrespectful, both in these emails, because the emails got really bad, where he would kind of, you know, say things to me like, oh, I'm going to go to the news. And I'm always like, sure, go, because maybe someone will find, maybe someone else will reach out and, you know, something will come from it. But there isn't anything I can do. The emails began to escalate. The phone calls began to escalate, where he is yelling at me over the phone. He is yelling at other people, and the emails have become quite disrespectful. He would calm down for a little bit, but then the behaviors would ratchet back up again. This went on for so long, and there were so many emails, so many phone calls, so many meetings. that is what I've had to deal with. And I will say what I knew that myself and other electeds were being harassed by him. But once he filed, and I was like, that allows me to talk about what I've been dealing with from him publicly, which I did. So I went on one of my social media pages and said, hey, this is what I've been dealing with. And other people shared that and more people commented their experiences with him. So after I shared what I had been dealing with, it was almost like a release. Like, I could finally talk about it with other people. This is what I've been experiencing from him. I'm running to get someone, a white man, who has harassed me and yelled and, like, just screamed for the last 2 years at a time when we're also dealing with our national politics and how you feel as a black person living in this country with our national politics devaluing my life, and then I'm having to run against some person who has absolutely treated me in an insane kind of way over these last 2 years, and that's who my opponent is.
This is an excerpt of our full interview with incumbent Alder Sabrina Madison. You can access the rest on our website, wortfm.org. More information about Alder Madison's re-election campaign is available on her website, madisonformadison.com. That's Madison for F-O-R Madison.com.
You're listening to Handcrafted Local News here on WORT. Stay with us. We've got a lot more stories for you coming up in the second half of the show. We'll get more details on last week's protest on Library Mall. We'll travel back in time to 1969, and we'll broadcast the most in-depth weather report on the airwaves.
Yes, how much snow will we see tonight? So stay tuned, but first we'll take a quick break and check back in with the BBC for a bulletin of world news. Stay tuned.
To say WORT 89.9 FM Madison.
WORT thanks its listener sponsors and Five Nines, a locally owned cloud service provider of enterprise-level IT infrastructure consulting, hosting, and management services. On the web at fivenines.com. Phone number 512-1000.
The WORT Board of Directors will hold its regularly scheduled meeting on Wednesday, March 19th at 6 p.m. in person at the station at 118 South Bedford Street. The public is welcome to attend. This meeting is also available virtually via Zoom. For information on how to attend this meeting virtually, please email president@wortfm.org.
BBC News. President Trump has suggested that Washington might take ownership of Ukraine's nuclear power plants to ensure their security. The surprise proposal came in his hour-long phone conversation with President Zelensky. It comes as the Trump administration also seeks to gain access to Ukraine's critical minerals. Thousands of people in Istanbul have taken part in demonstrations against the arrest of the city's mayor, Ekrem İmamoğlu, who's seen as the main political rival to Turkey's president. The opposition has described the move as a coup. A day after resuming airstrikes on Gaza, the Israeli military has extended its ground operations in the territory. Earlier, the UN said one of its compounds was damaged by an explosion, killing two people, including a UN staff member. Israel says it's investigating. Mexico's Attorney General has criticized state officials for their investigation into a ranch, where a gang is feared to have disposed of hundreds of bodies. Alejandro Gertz said there'd been a series of failings at the site in Jalisco. A jury in the US has found Greenpeace must pay hundreds of millions of dollars in damages to a major pipeline operator. Energy Transfer had accused the environmental group of defamation. The claim centered on efforts to disrupt a project in North Dakota. The US Central Bank has again kept interest rates unchanged. The Federal Reserve is waiting to see the wider effects of President Trump's global tariffs. Two far-right parties in Romania have announced George Simion as their candidate for May's rescheduled presidential election. He replaces Calin Georgescu, who's banned from running again after his first-round victory was annulled. And the European Space Agency has released its first batch of data from its Euclid Space Telescope.
The time is now 6:32, and you're listening to the live local news on WORT. I'm your host, Robert McClure, here with my co-host, Vicki Iden. Thank you for staying with us.
Up next is Cardinal Call, our weekly segment featuring news from the UW-Madison campus. A key figure in last spring's pro-Palestine protests at Columbia University in New York City was arrested earlier this month by ICE agents, sparking a demonstration last week on UW-Madison's Library Mall. Host Oliver Gerhars sat down with Daily Cardinal copy chief Zoe Elwood to learn more.
Hello and welcome to Cardinal Call, your biweekly dose of news from UW-Madison's own Daily Cardinal student newspaper. We are your hosts, Oliver Gerhars
and Ted Hingstrom.
Last week, Columbia University graduate and pro-Palestine protest leader Mahmoud Khalil was arrested by immigration officials in New York as a part of the Trump administration's effort to crack down on participants in protests that they call, quote, illegal and anti-Semitic, unquote. Last Tuesday, about 100 UW-Madison students and community members participated in a walkout in support of Khalil. Today we're joined by Zoe Elwood, one of the Daily Cardinal's copy chiefs, to discuss her reporting on the protest and the general concerns that the UW-Madison community is facing after Khalil's arrest. Thanks for coming on the show, Zoe.
Thank you for having me.
So first, I want to ask a little bit more about the Columbia protester who was arrested. Can you tell me a little bit more about his story?
So Mahmoud Khalil, he was a Columbia University graduate who was Palestinian, and he was a pro-Palestinian protester who was actually a lead negotiator for the encampments they had in the last year. He was arrested in his apartment on the 8th. ICE agents came to his apartment to arrest him and said they came from like the State Department to like revoke his student visa. But he doesn't have a student visa. He's like a legal...
He's already graduated now, hasn't he?
He's a graduate, but he's also a legal permanent resident of the United States. He called his lawyer and his lawyer talked to an agent and was like, he doesn't have a student visa. He has a green card. But then the agents were just like, we're just going to revoke his green card instead. Then they detained him and they took him to a detention center in Louisiana, which was, he has an 8-month pregnant wife. According to his lawyer, they tried to arrest the wife too, but she's an American citizen. So he's in Louisiana in one of the detention centers. And I know at the protest that I went to, one of the speakers, she said this, I don't know too much about it, but she said like the Louisiana detention center is like one of the harsher ones.
So on the topic of more specifically that protest from last week, what was it like when you actually got to Library Mall? I wanted to avoid using this word, but I can't think of another way to say it. What were the vibes there? Was it tense? Was it there an outrage? Was it more somber?
So I got there really early. So I got there when there was just a couple people there first. And at first, it was just a few members of the Students for Justice in Palestine. And they had a cart playing Palestinian music and then filled with protest signs. And I talked to a few of them and just got like their perspective on it. And it was basically just, they were very passionate about this, obviously, like for freedom of speech. And then as more people started to come, the crowd grew, obviously, like you said earlier, around 100 people. And then they got speakers up and they spent a good chunk of the time doing chants. And that was like you could hear the passion behind it. And they all sounded very like angry. And then they had speakers come up, told Khalil stories, told their stories. And it was all just very from the heart. And then as they went down Library Mall, they also chanted. And like 100 people doesn't seem like that many, and it doesn't look like that many, but it was like echoing throughout the campus.
What were the primary concerns that the protesters here at UW-Madison had?
First of all, like with Trump's administration, who wants to crack down on all these protesters because they believe pro-Palestine is, as he said, like anti-Semitic and supporting, like, as he said, a terrorist group. Dalia Saba, who's a member of SJP, she said, she's like, they're using this, like these arrests as an intimidation to silence voices. So their biggest concern is the silence of their voices and also like, or the right to protest. So like, I felt like that was the biggest point that they were trying to make through these protests.
Is there anyone at UW-Madison who is concerned that they might be facing similar punishment to Khalil?
I know that recently the U.S. Department of Education came out with a list of 60 universities that are going under investigation for anti-Semitic discrimination and harassment complaints under the Trump administration, and UW-Madison was one of them. I remember Dalia Saba, once again, she mentioned this. They're going to try to take our federal funding away. They're going to try to silence us. So they're worried about that specifically happening in Madison. They mentioned something about how they're already like cracking down on when and where they can hold their protests and how far away it can be from like buildings.
So they were concerned about sort of the expressive activity policy and what that's been looking like on campus?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So do you have any updates regarding further developments on things that have happened since this protest?
I just heard recently about more arrests being made at Columbia University. And I don't know too much about it, but I do know that there was another protest held for pro-Palestine at UW-Madison. I think actually it was at the Capitol, but there are still protests occurring, and I think they're occurring more nationwide as well, not just at Madison and not just at Columbia. It's just against the Trump administration and everything.
So is there anything else in particular about this story that, while you were reporting on this, really stuck out to you?
I'm like trying to think. Like, what really stuck out to me is like them bringing up the 60 universities a part of the list of for investigations, because like that obviously hits close to home because it's our university. So that really stuck out to me that we're a part of that and how that there could be a crackdown on our university and our students and like our peers. But I think that was what stuck out to me the most.
What are people concerned that kind of crackdown might look like? I mean, when you say crackdown, that's definitely got a negative connotation to it. What are the concerns that might look like for UW?
I just know people are like most concerned about the stripping of rights away from students and specifically like Palestinian students, because as we've seen in the protests with like Columbia, a lot of those arrests were Palestinian students. Are they worried about that at UW-Madison? But also just like basically like one of the things that they said specifically is that they're calling on UW-Madison to respect the rights of students and to have free speech.
Yeah, one thing that I also noticed was that, like, the group of students, I know we've mostly been talking about Khalil, who was the first person deported. I think there's been one, maybe two others. But that's the thing, is that they're being, I mean, I guess, I'm sorry, I should say said deported, because what I'm trying to say is they are immigrants. I mean, the threat isn't to deport them, it's detained. But a lot of this is enabled because of Trump's very harsh anti-immigrant stance. And I think that the, empowering of ICE has definitely been a big part of this, because the only people facing those consequences are those who were born outside of the U.S.
Yeah, this just is like all based with the Trump administration and their pledge to detain and deport student activists and the response from students and the anger they felt from these executive orders.
Yeah, thanks for coming on this week, Zoe.
Okay, thank you so much for having me. In other campus news, Governor Tony Evers visits campus residence hall. Last week, Governor Tony Evers was joined by Chancellor Jennifer Mnuchin during a visit to Chadbourne Residence Hall in the Moss Humanities Building. The governor stopped in a dorm room that was recently converted from a common study area in a response to a campus housing shortage. Evers said, quote, "We absolutely need to make sure that especially our freshmen have a chance to live in dorms and don't have to jump together with three or four other people in a room that's not made to be a bedroom," unquote.
In campus sports news, Badger basketball loses to the Wolverines. After two upset wins against UCLA and Michigan State on Friday and Saturday, this Sunday the Badgers will be going into March Madness at a loss after losing to the University of Michigan Wolverines with a final score of 59-53. That's all for the Cardinal Call this week. We've been your hosts, Oliver Gerhars
and Ted Hingstrom. You can find more news and stories from UW-Madison's student journalists at dailycardinal.com.
And it's time now for the most comprehensive weather report on the airwaves with WORT weather expert, Rob McClure.
Well, after having overpredicted the possibility of thunderstorms with the last couple of big spring storms that came through, we did finally get our first few rumbles of thunder this morning, just after 8 a.m., with a dying thunderstorm cell that was in the process of elevating over the cold, low-level air here as it sped northeastward ahead of this very latest spring storm out to our west. The cold pool over us at that time was a good 5,000 or 6,000 feet deep, at least judging from the model sounding. So even though we did have some decent moisture and warmth flowing in up above that, the storms did dissipate pretty abruptly once they got past Madison and elevated all the way up into the colder and generally saturated column higher up. Indeed, between the deep saturation that we saw this morning and the lowering ceilings that we had underneath those thunderstorms, we did get some spectacularly dark skies. In fact, the streetlights went back on in my neighborhood around 10:30, at least for 20 minutes or half an hour. A little over half an inch of rain has come down so far with this system, and we'll continue to get some wet snow out of this for another few hours at least tonight, though it's a little unclear at this point exactly how much accumulation we'll see before we get to tomorrow morning. This storm is impressive to view on satellite, and I invite you to have a look on either the visible spectrum channel image of the upper Midwest that we have linked on the WORT weather webpage, or also on the water vapor view of the entire U.S., which is actually right up at the top of the page. That latter sequence, which goes back 3 days, shows the upper-level wave with this storm, the upper trough, sliding east off the Pacific Ocean on Monday, then across the Great Basin and spinning up a surface low-pressure circulation over eastern Colorado and Kansas late yesterday, which then ejects east-northeastward from there across northern Missouri and central Illinois today on a track a little further south than we were expecting. So that's kept the severe weather confined actually well down in Illinois, at least in central Illinois, along the surface warm front where there were a couple of confirmed tornadoes this afternoon near Peoria. Up here, the primary forecast question is how much snow we're going to see with this system in the coming overnight. The air column appears now to have cooled sufficiently in many places, especially around Madison and north and west, to be producing snow. In Rock and Walworth counties, there are also some model indications that another brief round of warming aloft related to the passage of the low, which is now over northeastern Illinois over the coming hours, may keep precipitation liquiform for a while yet this evening. But in general, areas from roughly Madison north and west look to get, I'd say, a good 5 or 6 hours of snow once the snow sets in again. until the column dries out behind the exiting system. That'll be towards about 3 or 4 in the morning tomorrow. Some decent periods of upward motion are indicated as we get on towards midnight, so that may make for some respectable accumulation rates after the snow gets going again another hour or two, so a couple of inches is still possible. A follow-on system then passing far to our north on Friday through Ontario will swing a late-day cold front southeastward through here, possibly providing enough lift and saturation at that time for some transient showers. Not too much of a concern there, I don't think. A more impactful system, though, does look to be on the cards for Sunday when a passing upper wave, or quite possibly two in tandem, north and south, will pass through the upper Midwest. The longer-range forecast models are currently generally preferring sending those waves to either side of us, but we're still likely, I think, to get in on a good bit of precipitation Sunday, possibly starting out as snow if it gets going early enough in the morning, and then perhaps switching over to rain and then back to snow as we get into the evening and overnight hours going into Monday. The models then generally hold us somewhat cooler than we've been through much of next week, so no more 60-degree temperatures, I don't think, for a while. Incidentally, yesterday's 63-degree high temperature helped March reach a 7-degree temperature surplus as of today, so a cooler week ahead should not come as any surprise. But back to tonight, the rain should continue to turn over to snow generally from northwest to southeast from Madison southeastward over the coming hours. The radar currently indicates that the rain-snow line is running southwest to northeast through about Madison. And we are dry now as the low-pressure system to our south passes over southern Lake Michigan over the coming hour or two. But we should see snow set back in, I think, in another hour or two here in Madison. The snow is maintaining, falling up in Sauk County, for example, so it doesn't have far to go to reach us again. Temperatures will slowly descend into the 20s as northerly winds continue to ramp up to 18 to 25 miles per hour and overnight, with some gustiness as well as colder air works in steadily behind the departing low-pressure system later on. That should plaster the falling snow, the winds will, onto the northwest sides of trees and houses and the like, because the snow will be quite wet. A couple of inches by dawn are possible, but with lower accumulations, I think for sure, to the south and southeast of Madison. Tomorrow, clearing skies in the morning should help get the temperature to respond back up into the mid or perhaps upper 30s, but that'll be despite continuing strong northwesterly winds, especially early in the day, up at 12 to 18 miles per hour. Gradually coming down later in the day to about 5 to 10 miles per hour by evening. Passing high clouds as we go then through the nighttime period should limit temperature falls to the upper 20s, as will backing of our northwesterly winds more west and southwest by Friday morning at 3 to 7 miles per hour. Friday should see increasing mostly high and mid-level clouds as warm air is drawn northward into the passing low up in Canada. Ceilings may lower a bit later in the day as the cold front behind the storm starts to approach from the northwest, and passing showers are possible, say, from late afternoon into the evening hours. Temperatures may hit 50 or so by mid-afternoon anyway, given southwesterly winds, which will be up to 12 to 18 miles per hour, with some gustiness as well, so that will make for some decent vertical mixing. Winds will veer more northwesterly as we go overnight into Saturday, and skies will clear out a bit more, allowing temperatures to drop back to the mid-20s. And Saturday should generally be sunny, with temperatures reaching 40 or so on lighter northwesterly winds at 5 to 10 miles per hour. The skies will cloud up more going overnight into Sunday, and precipitation chances generally increase as we reach daybreak on Sunday, with the heaviest precipitation, though, probably holding off until the afternoon hours, with temperatures in the low 40s that day. The temperature currently at the station on Bedford Street is 34 degrees. The dew point temperature is 32. The snow has stopped for the moment, but we're overcast up at about 1,500 feet. Winds are out of the north at 12 miles per hour, still gusting well above 20 miles per hour from time to time. The barometer is at 29.54 inches of mercury and now beginning to rise. Thank you.
It's now 6:49 p.m. and you're listening to the live local news on WORT. We go now to March 1969, when the university supported Black studies but cracked down on student protests. Two prominent feminists demanded equal rights, and another young Madison man died in Vietnam. Stu Levitan has the news from 56 years ago this month on tonight's Madison in the 60s.
They melt into a dream.
Madison in the 60s, March 1969. On the 3rd, the UW faculty votes to create an autonomous, degree-granting Department of Afro-American Studies within the College of Letters and Science, the primary demand of the Black People's Alliance during the recent Black Studies strike. The proposal, approved 540 to 414, now goes to the Regents and the Coordinating Committee on Higher Education. Student housing could be coming to the far west side, as the University Planning Committee approves construction of 800 apartment units on the university-owned Reeder Farm on the southeast corner of Whitney Way and Mineral Point Road. If the Coordinating Committee and the legislature endorse the plan, the first 150 units could be ready by the fall of 1971. On the 6th, several state senators demand the UW Regents fire American history teaching assistant Ann Gordon for, quote, bad character, because as editor of the underground paper Connections, she published an article by Jim Rowan featuring frequent use of a four-letter obscenity. Influential state senator Fred Risser comes to her defense, and Gordon continues as editor and TA. It's a month of the Empire fighting back. On the 4th, the state Senate, by voice vote, gives final legislative approval to a bill barring students convicted of crimes during university disruptions from receiving state financial aid for 2 years. 2 days later, the Regents hold a special meeting to enact an emergency administrative rule to ban students suspended or expelled for illegal acts during demonstrations or non-students convicted of such acts from entering any UW campus for a year. Regent Vice President James Nellen, team physician for the Green Bay Packers, also wanted all students fingerprinted, but the board voted that down. The Equal Opportunities Commission agrees to draft an ordinance banning bias on the basis of sex after a presentation by Alder Alicia Ashman and National Organization for Women co-founder Dr. Catherine Klarenbach. The two women from the Near West Side report that several city ordinances discriminate against women from employment to banking. Even in Madison, Ashman says, quote, unwed mothers employed by the city are ineligible for maternity benefits. And it was in 1966 that the EOC said the city should not grant a liquor license to any private club that had racially restrictive membership policies. The council agreed, with enforcement to start, quote, at some future date after 1969. So the EOC opens an inquiry to see if any of Madison's 14 private clubs with liquor licenses have charters limiting membership to white males. The same three clubs that did in 1966, the Eagles, Elks, and Moose, still do. At least Madison Elks Lodge 410 is trying to change. In late March, more than 250 members vote almost unanimously for a resolution calling on its National Grand Lodge to eliminate the white males provision. The Grand Lodge refuses to do so. It was even longer ago, in 1853, that Abel and Pamela Dunning, the first Europeans to plant crops in Dane County, built the Greek Revival farmhouse they called Mapleside, far out of town on what would become University Avenue. But now its owner, Developer Dan Neviser wants to knock it down and build a gas station and restaurant, much to the outrage of historic preservationists. In March, he offers to donate Mapleside to the Te Chapra Foundation, the group of local preservationists that formed last April, for the foundation to remove. He suggests it could be moved, quote, just a few feet to the west for about $70,000. Te Chapra wants a site in the Arboretum, but is not able to acquire one, putting Mapleside's future in jeopardy. The FBI releases statistics showing that all crimes except auto theft have increased in Madison from 1967 to 69. 2 weeks later, Madison Police Chief Wilbur Emery complains to a joint legislative committee about, quote, a most disturbing lack of enforcement and initiative from the university in curbing campus drug traffic, which he says has forced him to assign drug investigators to campus without being asked. He strongly endorses legislation to have Madison take over law enforcement on campus, a bill which passes the assembly and is set for Senate consideration in January 1970. And students arrested may be bailed out thanks to a fund created by the new Mifflin Street Community Co-op called the Electric Tetradactyl Transit Authority. When the co-op opened on January 13th, it was run by volunteers. But by March, sales are averaging $700 a week, so in addition to the bail fund, full-time staff start to receive a weekly salary of $42. When the city opened the reconstructed University Avenue in November 1966, the entire campus community said having an eastbound lane for buses while the other four lanes went west was dangerous. On March 18th, Circuit Judge Jackman rules it was also illegal, that the city cannot reserve the lane for the exclusive use of the Madison Bus Company, so he dismisses the ticket attorney Ken Herr got for driving there. The city doesn't appeal, but continues to enforce the ban on private use of the bus lane, much to the disapproval of Circuit Judge Richard Bardwell, who says he'll impose, quote, some severe financial penalties if the city issues any more tickets, including for false arrest. The city arrests students in disorderly conduct cases, he notes, adding, quote, how does it expect the students to obey the law when it fails to do so itself? Big change is coming to the Capitol Square. As First National Bank announces it will raise its 47-year-old building at the corner of South Pinckney Street and East Washington Avenue and construct a 9-story multi-million-dollar complex awash in glass. And Army Specialist 4th Class Lyle C. Hansbrough, 25, son of Mrs. Lyle Hansbrough, 4817 Bayfield Terrace, and the late Dr. Hansbrough, is killed in action in Gyadin Province on March 17th. A graduate of West High School and Whitewater State University, he was drafted in February 1968 and had been in country since last July. And that's this week's Madison in the 60s. For your award-winning, listener-supported WORT News Team, I'm Stu Levitan.
And that does it for our show this evening. Thanks for listening to WORT's live local news at 6. Our headline writers this evening were Greg Sanderson and Jack Goodman. Reporting was courtesy of Mike Mullen of the Wisconsin News Connection. Special thanks to our feature contributors, Oliver Gerhartz, Ted Hingstrom, and Stu Levitan. Katie Giorgella is our engineer on Wednesdays. Faye Park produced the newscast, and Shally Pittman is the news director at WORT. I'm your host, Robert McClure.
And I'm your host, Vicki Iden. Stay up to date with the WORT Local News Podcast. Subscribe on iTunes Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever else you get your podcasts. Up next is Query, followed by This Way Out. Good night.
Find yourself more enraged with every news headline?
Do you have crippling anxiety when you see pictures of starving polar bears on melting icebergs?
Are you shaking your fists at every new threat to bodily autonomy?
If you answered yes to these questions, we have an answer for you. Her Turn, WORT's feminist news, airs every Sunday at 11 a.m., and the Collective is looking for new volunteers to join us.
No previous experience needed, just a commitment to feminist news and a willingness to bring more women's voices to the radio. Call 608-256-2001 and say you want to volunteer on Her Turn.
Turn your anger into action. Turn your anxiety into hopefulness. Turn your discouragement into power. Volunteer with Her Turn right here on WORT Madison and make your woman's voice heard.
Hi friends, Vicki here. I'm hosting Query tonight, but wanted to give you a quick public service announcement. On April 5th at Brittingham Park on West Washington, it's 829 West Washington, April 5th from 1 o'clock until 4 o'clock, there's a trans and queer community potluck. The objective here is to just meet neighbors and meet some organizations that are working to build community power and resilience here in Madison and Dane County.